and welcome to the Doula and Midwife podcast with me, Charlene Yared-West, founder of Relax Into Birth Online Hypnobirthing, and the amazing virtual midwife, Karen Wilmot.
Oh, stop.
We came together to bring you Relax Into Birth Plus, our comprehensive online antenatal course focusing on labor, birth, and beyond, featuring extensive hypnobirthing techniques and a deep understanding of the physiology of birth and methods to avoid unnecessary medical interventions. We always have so much to talk about, and so this podcast was born. And here we share birth stories, birthing world updates, we interview birth workers from near and far, and also we take the time to answer your burning questions around pregnancy, birth, and motherhood. How are you, Karen?
Well, as per our intro, where we say we always take time to answer those burning questions, today we have another little email from one of our listeners asking about birth plans. I think that's a great thing to chat about in our podcast today. So I'll quickly share with you what she said. She said, "Dear Charlene and Karen, I am now 32 weeks pregnant and all my friends have told me that I should be writing a birth plan. It wasn't something that I previously considered, but I'm beginning to think that maybe I need to and I have no idea where to start. Please help." There's a lot of mixed messages about birth plans at the moment. One of them is that people are saying, you know, you can't plan birth, which is true. We can't. Birth is unpredictable. And then the languaging around it of saying, rather than saying a birth plan, we talk about birth preferences. And I think both of those are valid points.
Yes, it should be called your birthday wish list.
Oh, I like that.
Because you don't always get everything you wish for on your birthday.
Yeah, okay, it's a nice way of putting it.
And it has to be flexible, always. Flexibility is key because life can be unpredictable.
So I love that it needs to be flexible, but how do you put that into a wish list that you want to keep it flexible?
Into a document.
But how does that document portray the flexibility aspect? Because one of the things I don't like about birth plans, as a midwife who used to get a lot of them handed to me, was things that were stated in the negative. I don't want an epidural. I don't want to use pain medication. Which isn't flexible, one, and also it's focusing on what they don't want as opposed to what they do want. So how do we bring that element of flexibility into a birth plan?
That's so important. I never thought of it in stating it in the negative, because often the mother's mind can change in the actual labor and she decides actually she does want pain relief or she does want that epidural.
Yeah, so
I think firstly it has to be short and sweet.
I definitely agree with that. Short and sweet. I don't want 3 pages. Or short and sweet is great, but I think that's the last version of it, which will be short and sweet. Because when you start it, actually it should be 3 to 5 pages.
That's true.
Because that flexibility that you're talking about is what needs to come in your preparation.
And discussion with your care provider.
Yeah.
Over your birth plan.
Yes. So the flexibility comes in your preparation where you understand, okay, this is what my preference is. This is what my wish is. But I understand that I won't necessarily get it because of these factors. And then you look at your internal factors and your external factors. And then you look at those that you can control and those that are out of your control. And then you see, okay, how flexible can I be with the ones that I can control? And how easily can I let go of the ones I cannot control?
Exactly. And this process of elimination, it can come to fruition with your care provider and ascertaining what is realistic, what isn't realistic, what is the hospital protocol, because you're also fighting against that, or aligning to that. Doesn't mean
aligning,
you have to fight.
Yeah, I think aligning to it. And also seeing how much of that alignment do I have to adhere to.
Yes. And where's the wiggle room?
I like the wiggle room.
Yeah.
I think it's the wiggle room. So for me, the wiggle room is very important because if we can get enough women to wiggle, 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 we can make that wiggle room but much bigger, much wider, and start shifting those very tight
rules
that do allow for a little bit of preference and also for seeing the woman as a unique individual, as opposed to this woman's labor will progress the same as everybody else's and it must go 1 centimeter per hour and everything, and understanding
yes And therefore, her birth preferences, her birth plan must be individualized as well. She shouldn't just copy from a friend.
Or a template online.
A template, yeah. So she really needs to go through each item. And I think that's really important for parents to know, is that birth plans, yes, you give them to your care provider, but more than anything, it's about educating yourself on on the options. And that's why it starts out with 5 to 10 pages and then whittles down to 1 page.
Yeah,
because you actually need to understand what every single item on that birth preference list means and what the implications are.
I think that your birth plan, if we're going to call it that, or your birth wish list, should be the culmination of your birth preparation, which includes the classes that you take, the people that you speak to, the books that you read, the movies or YouTube videos that you watch. All of those should ultimately inform what your preferences and your wish list are, and should include, not necessarily written down and in the plan, but what have you done to prepare yourself? What coping strategies and mechanisms and tools have you learned and practiced and brought into your own preparation? So if you're talking about pain management, which is one of the big things in a birth wish list, you know, it's understanding what are your options and which are the ones that you would like to, you know, what is your preference and what have you done? If you're saying, I don't want to use any drugs at all, what's the alternative? What have you done?
Hopefully you've done some hypnobirthing and some other mental preparation for that.
Yeah, one would think.
Yeah, you need coping mechanisms if you're saying things like that.
Yeah, and I think it's really important, you know, if we go back to the thing of saying, I don't want pain medication, what do you want then? And how are you going to manage?
Yeah.
So making sure that whatever you've put there, you really do understand all aspects of that statement.
Because it's a springboard for conversation with your care provider.
Totally.
Ongoing conversation at every single prenatal visit you have.
Yeah.
You're discussing these points. And you're making them put your finalized birth preferences into your file, so that when you go into labor, the midwives on duty have access to your file with your birth plan in it. And on the day, you also have made a few copies just in case.
And I think at the end of the day, by the time you have really brought that your wish list down to one page after exploring all of those different options, it's going to look much like most other birth wish lists. And there's certain things that will be included. So should we maybe go through some of those?
And I think before we do, it's also important to say that care providers differentiate between life items and then quality of life items.
Can you explain life a bit what you mean by that?
So what's important and keeping mom and baby healthy and alive, those are options. And then there are nice to haves.
Okay, so kind of like choose your arguments.
Yes.
You know, like.
And that's why they have to be flexible, because in the moment, they have to make sure that you survive. It sounds so intense to say it in that way, but they're not going to be caring about delayed cord clamping when they have to, in an emergency situation.
If it's going to affect the, or impact the outcome.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I hear what you're saying there. So let's go through some of those then, and we can actually look at them through that lens of those things that are nice to have and those things that might impact the outcome.
Yes.
Okay.
How far into your labor would you like to remain at home, and at what point would you prefer to go to the hospital or birth place?
See, so for me personally, I don't think that's something that I would put on my wish list.
Yes.
Because that's something that you take control of that. And if you discuss that with your care provider, they're going to say you need to come in the moment you start experiencing labor, because they want you there from their perspective.
Yes.
So you've got to really trust that you feel okay to be at home for as long as you possibly can. We talked about this in other podcast, where we talked about how long to stay at home, and that actually it is your preference.
Yes.
How comfortable you feel staying at home longer, and how important that is for you. So it's not something I would necessarily have on my birth list that I would discuss with my doctor. It's something you've got to come to on your own. This is how long I want to stay. Once I get into the hospital, then you're not handing over the care to hospital, but you're understanding that the resources you have at home are not enough anymore. Yes. So I'm now coming into the hospital environment where I do have those resources and where I now am seeking that assistance.
Yes. Or it's time to go in and have your baby.
Or it's time to, exactly. So yeah.
Eating or drinking during active labor. I've never really been at a hospital in Cape Town where they've said no eating in labor, no eating or drinking labor, unless there's a scheduled seizure happening.
Once again, I don't think that's something it should be, because I don't think you should ever have to request to eat.
It's like the dark ages.
It's totally the dark ages. The reality is that most women don't want to eat in active labor.
Yeah.
You know,
even a grape can be too much.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, and I'm not going to ask permission to eat a grape.
No.
So that can go out.
Being out of bed, walking around or sitting up during labor, being mobile.
That's obviously a discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a discussion that would be good to have with your care provider, because you actually, all you want is to be reassured that you will be given freedom of movement. Because once again, we've chatted about this in a lot of our podcasts of how important activity is and how important it is to the progress of your labor to be able to move around and change your position.
Yes.
To create space for the baby to move down. So when you are, when that is hindered for some reason.
Well, what goes hand in hand with that is continuous monitoring versus intermittent monitoring.
Yeah, and that would be a question that you can have and a discussion to have with your care provider and with the staff in the labor room to see what their standard practices are. And I think it's one of those things as well that you can take in some research and do your own research, you know, about the benefits and drawbacks of intermittent versus continuous fetal monitoring, and when continuous is necessary and when intermittent is okay. And there's some great stuff on that on the evidence-based birth website where they look at all the different,
yes,
you know. And in the majority of labors that are progressing well, in a low-risk case, intermittent is recommended and is actually the best.
And many hospitals actually also have a small handheld Doppler in some dark little cupboard
that they can
away.
Use. Absolutely.
So you just have to request it. If you're in the bath and you don't want to get out, you can say, I've heard that you have one of these. Could you please use it? Just so that you can stay in the bath a little bit longer if that's where you want to be.
Yes, absolutely. And so intermittent is definitely preferable in a low-risk labor that's progressing well.
Yes. And then personalizing the atmosphere with music, lighting, and items from home.
Ooh, that's your speciality.
Yeah. So that you can just assert that that's what you'd like to do.
I think it's one of those things that also you do, actually.
Yes.
Shouldn't really...
Yeah,
have to ask permission for that.
Yes.
You know, it's not impacting anything in any way. It is just creating a homely atmosphere in a clinical environment. Wouldn't put it in my birth plan. It would be taking up too much space.
Yes.
But do it anyway.
Because that's what you intend to do.
Yeah.
And it's not harming anyone.
No.
It's just enhancing your labor. So another one is the use of a still camera or video camera. I have seen parents use a GoPro. Dads.
Me too. In the birth pool.
Oh my word.
Yeah, that's the thing these days. And
yeah,
I mean, I think it's just about saying at one of your visits, is it allowed? You know?
Yes.
Because sometimes there are some medico-legal things around that.
Yes.
But if it is, then there shouldn't be any reason why you can't.
And the use of a mirror so that you can see the birth.
Once again, should just...
Yeah,
there's
just
no reason why
you
shouldn't
just
pack that in your birth bag.
Yes, and request to see it if you want to.
If you want to, yeah. No, everybody wants to see it, but
so nice that's to see the baby emerging.
Mm. See the baby crowning.
So the use of an IV, but this would be only in certain instances.
It would be, but there are some hospitals that have a protocol that when you arrive in labor, they put an IV in as a matter of routine, so that in the event of needing any IV medication or in the event of an emergency, that access is already there. So they don't necessarily hook you up to any IV fluid, they just leave the cannula in. But it can be really, really uncomfortable, painful, and it's one more potential risk for infection. Now, the risk of infection by putting an IV in is very low, admittedly, because we do it in sterile conditions.
Yes.
But if it's not necessary, then it's one of those things that I think is you could have that conversation.
In general, it's a requirement for VBACs.
For VBACs, yes, because that is classified as high risk. So you do want to have it. But in a low risk labor that's progressing well, I think there's wiggle room.
Yes.
That's wiggle a wiggle room, room.
Wiggle
one.
Room, yes.
Okay, great.
Another one is the use of pain medication and the type of pain medication.
Oh, now this is the one that I think definitely has to go in, but it's also the one that has to be explored, and you've got to do your homework around it.
You've got to give yourself wiggle room here.
Definitely. Yes, and explore what your beliefs are around that. What do you actually want? What would you prefer? Without knowing anything, what is your preferences? Like before you start your birth preparation, you might expect that the pain is going to be 10 out of 10 and you definitely want all the drugs and everything. And then you do some preparation and you change your perspective and you have a deeper understanding, and it puts you onto a 5 out of 10 or an open mind, or maybe I will, maybe I won't, I'm not quite sure, or absolutely I don't want anything, but I am going to do hypnobirthing and that's going to be it.
A good way to word it is to say, please don't offer me pain relief, I'll ask for it if I want it.
It's a great way. And you know, the psychology behind that is that if you are in that vulnerable state where it seems like you might be needing it, and then a medical professional comes along and offers it, and you know that that medical professional does this all the time, then you immediately think, oh, I must need it if they're offering it.
Yeah, it's dangling a carrot.
Exactly. Whereas if you go in knowing that it's available, it's there, whether you ask for it or not, it's there, then you will reach out and ask for it when you need it, as and when you need, and you may not need it. So
exactly. Another one is the use of oxytocin to induce or augment contractions. That is also dependent on the labor.
Yeah.
A lot of the time you don't have much choice with that if you're in hospital, right?
Yes, and I think if it's to induce labor, you do, and it would be a decision that's made possibly at your 40-week or your 41-week appointment, then there is wiggle room and there's time to have a conversation and look at the reason that they are offering that induction. And is it a medical indication? What is it? So you've definitely got wiggle room there. But if you're already in labor and they are wanting to use oxytocin to augment the labor or speed things up, you've still got wiggle room and you still want to ask all those same questions, but there could be a valid reason that they want to, or not.
Exactly.
Or not. But you have to feel confident enough to be able to say, well, why are you offering this to me now? You know, what changed since my labor began 7 hours ago when I came in? What is not happening that we want to happen? And what would happen if we don't do this now? How much longer could we continue without augmenting the labor? Whatever. So those kinds of questions.
And it should also be understood that oxytocin, synthetic oxytocin, can in some instances help your labor.
It can.
So
it's not a bad thing.
The evil.
Exactly.
Of labor.
Exactly. And I think that goes back to understanding how it works and when it's offered, and being able to have that conversation, but being flexible. That's where the flexibility comes in.
Exactly.
But the flexibility can only come in when they understand both sides, both the benefits and the drawbacks, and then being able to do a benefit risk
assessment.
Yeah.
And then labor and birth positions. So positions during labor, and then more importantly, options for positions during birth. The pushing step.
Yeah, that's a big one, hey, because I know that especially in hospitals, the doctors really do like you to be in the traditional position where they have full view with you, not necessarily lying flat on your back, but on your back or sitting up.
Yes.
You know, the view changes once you flip over and you're on your hands and knees.
Yes.
And so that's a conversation I'd have with the care provider and say, how happy are you if for some reason I happen to be on my hands and knees or squatting.
Or on the floor.
Or on the floor or standing. And I know in hospitals they don't like it on the floor.
Yes.
Or squatting or any positions like that. And in some hospitals, they do have the beds that are able, you know, with the bars where you're able to make it into like a squat where you're on the bed, and that's the ideal situation. But I think it's a conversation you need to have with your doctor and see how comfortable they are in different positions. And you will see by their body language when you have that, you know, if they immediately sort of like close up and, well, you know, you don't know what it's like, it's just whatever.
Then you know, you say probably... you can bring a knee pillow for them. You can order them a on knee Take pillow. A Lot. They've specifically made for your knees.
I think it's one of those ones that if enough women start asking for it, it will become standard practice that birthing rooms don't necessarily just have a bed. They have other spaces available for you to find one that works for you. Because most women, I don't know if you've noticed this, but most women want to be on a cool tiled floor.
Yes.
Curled up in a little ball.
Exactly. That's
on the
more
toilet.
Common than being on the bed.
Exactly. There's one more thing I want to say about positions.
Yes.
Is that I don't think anybody can say what position they would like to give birth in.
Yes. That's important.
That's where the flexibility comes in, is that you can't actually know in advance what position will feel right for you, because so often, and I used to see this, I don't want to give birth on my back. And halfway through their labor, they're in bed on their back.
Yes.
So you don't know how you're going to feel when you're there. So you have to be flexible.
And also it's about getting the baby down onto the perineum. And then a laid back position is not the worst thing after
Sometimes
that.
Sometimes it isn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, there isn't a wrong position in labor. The wrong position is the one that doesn't feel right. So perineal massage and...
warm compresses.
Yes. I think this is a good conversation. Again, this is another one of those ones that you've got to have a conversation with your care provider, because you want to know what their practice is around episiotomies and whether or not they're going to support you. If you haven't listened to the podcast episode we did on episiotomies and perineal tearing, I encourage you to do that, because we talked a little bit more about that and all the things that you can do. And I think it goes without saying that every woman is going to say in her birth plan, I would prefer to avoid an episiotomy.
Yes.
And tearing. So, you know, what are you doing during your pregnancy to prepare for that? And have you had that uncomfortable conversation with your care provider to make sure that they are going to support you and your perineum?
Exactly. And I think if listeners are interested, they really should go back and listen to that podcast.
Absolutely.
On episiotomies. And then vacuum extraction or instrumental delivery. Forceps use?
I think that's the one that you spoke about, you know, where it comes to something where if it's suggested, it's probably because we need to speed up. So something isn't going quite right. Yeah, it's quite difficult to not or to say no to the using the vacuum.
Yes.
If it's been suggested, because it's not something that's done unless it's necessary, usually.
Yes.
Usually. However, what you can do, and what is really important that you do, is, and this is your preparation, and this is all about you and you working with your body, it goes back to you staying active, you moving into positions that guides the baby down, and the most important one is not pushing unless you have the urge to push. Because that's very often when a vacuum ends up being needed.
Yes.
Is if you started pushing too early just because your cervix was dilated to 10 centimeters, but you didn't actually have a very strong urge to push. So that means that you are now responsible for moving your baby down that last centimeter or so until it actually hits the area where those nerves are stimulated. And just 1 centimeter is incredibly difficult.
Yes.
And can, which leads to maternal exhaustion, probably fetal exhaustion. So then you've got fetal distress, and then a vacuum is indicated. Because now we need to help you to bring the baby down.
Yes.
As opposed to using your own efforts, but you just don't have them anymore because you're exhausted.
And another time would it would be used is for an epidural.
Or an epidural, yes. If you can't feel it.
If you can't feel it.
If you can't feel it.
Push as effectively as what you would.
Yeah, but even then, I think that if you let the baby come down enough,
yes,
then that feeling of fullness, even though you don't feel the pressure, you feel the feeling of fullness, and you're able to work with it a little bit more effectively.
Yes.
Or if there is no fetal distress, to switch the epidural off. If there's no fetal distress and the cervix is 10 centimeters, but you can't feel anything, Switch the epidural off, give it another hour and a half.
Mm.
By that time, there's enough feeling back where the feeling starts coming back, she's going to have that urge to push.
Yes.
And she'll be able to use it, as opposed to pushing when the epidural is in full force.
I was at two different births last week. And the first one, she had an epidural, and there was a lot of effort she had to put into pushing the baby out. It took about 20 to 30 minutes,
okay,
which isn't generally very long at all.
But it's hard work when you're pushing like that.
And so she put a lot of work into that. And then the second birth, which was at the same hospital right away, was another birth, another epidural. And her baby, if I hadn't lifted her dress to check, the baby was just crowning without her even knowing it. With
because,
the epidural running.
I know. And don't you just love those?
Yeah, it was awesome.
You see, now that is the fetal ejection reflex in action.
It was fantastic.
Mm, mm. And that's why if we switch it off, then that's what's going to happen.
Yes, going to happen. Fetal ejection reflex kicks in. Another one is cesarean delivery. And I think there's so much to be said around that. Because there's always so many options as well around... How do I have a gentle cesarean? Does my care provider even know about a gentle cesarean? What about skin to skin in a cesarean?
Conversation.
It's another podcast, Karen.
Gentle cesarean. Yeah, and I think what I do want to say about that is that a cesarean is always an option. It's always there and it's always on the table.
Yes.
And it's always available.
Yes.
It's not something that and everybody's going to say, I don't want one unless it's necessary, unless they're actually planning an elective cesarean.
Exactly.
So we know that every woman who comes in with a birth preferences wish list wants to have a vaginal birth.
Yes.
And that's a given.
Exactly. And you can include option B preferences.
Yeah.
You to know, an extent.
One of the beautiful things from the book Birthing From Within,
yes,
is where they talk about giving birth in awareness rather than having a specific birth outcome. And I think that's what your birth wish list is all about. What am I doing to prepare myself during pregnancy so that when I go into labor, I can give birth in awareness, not just about giving birth vaginally,
yes,
or whatever. That understanding that I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, birthing consciously.
Yeah.
Right. The presence of significant others during labor, in other words, the number of birth companions you can have at your side.
Well, I think in COVID times now, that's very dependent on actually,
yes,
what's allowed and testing and all of that. So
COVID times have definitely changed things around that.
Mm.
But before COVID, you could have everyone, including the kitchen sink. According to the Better Births Initiative, you can have as many
Birth companions
as you like.
And so you should.
You can motivate for it.
Yeah. If you would like that. I mean, to me, it's like the equivalent of inviting people around to watch,
yes,
you make love. But
exactly. And they say every person in the room adds an hour to your labor.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I probably agree with that, actually, in my experience of having lots of people around. Yep. Definitely.
So be very picky. The presence of older children at the delivery or immediately after. Again, COVID has changed things around that, and that's more at a home birth than
at
a hospital. Suctioning of the newborn, holding the baby immediately after birth, and breastfeeding immediately.
I think those should be given. I mean, it should be standard. And in most hospitals, it is standard. If there's no need for resuscitation or any attention to the baby, and there's no other place that it should be than on mom's chest.
Yes.
And even if there is a resuscitation, it should really be done right next to her with the cord still intact and the
bed.
And
I think they meant suctioning of the fluids out.
Yeah, and even that is a little bit controversial at the moment. Like,
yeah,
we've
many
sort of
places
stopped
doing
don't that.
Do it.
You know, it used to be that we did that as a standard practice for many, many years, and now I really don't, it's certainly not standard anymore.
Yes, good.
Yeah.
The other thing that comes up often, which women think is standard, is eye drops for the baby. Why do they do it?
It's an antibiotic to prevent any eye infections if the mom had any.
Gosh.
Yeah. There is, once again, it's one of those controversial things. There's a whole handout on evidence-based birth. but it is still, in most hospitals, it is still standard.
So you can request.
And maybe. You can request that it not be given.
Okay.
Certainly in the government hospitals here in South Africa. So I don't know about the private, but I know that in the birth centre I work in, they do it.
Yeah, in the private hospitals, it's not a standard. Even
isn't
when
it?
They do the vitamin K, no.
Okay.
And vitamin K is another option on the birth preferences.
Mm-hmm. And once again, looking into the benefits, drawbacks, all of that, so you understand it. It really is a decision that you as a parent make.
Yes.
You know, that's the first of many decisions that you as a parent make. So you understand why vitamin K is given and whether or not you would like your baby to have it. And the chloromycin eye drops.
Cutting the cord and postponing cutting the cord, weighing the baby, administering the eye drops, which you've just mentioned, and waiting until you greet your baby.
Well, I think that kind of goes to the golden hour, but the cutting the cord, I'm hoping that within another year or two, it'll be standard practice worldwide that delayed cord clamping is just what we do.
Wait for what?
It is still, I think, in the process of change, but certainly the research has been long enough now and there's enough research to show the benefits of delayed cord clamping. And so it is definitely becoming more widespread that hospitals are changing their policies. But
not quite at lotus births.
Not there yet. But you know, they say that it takes 5 years for hospital policies to change once the research shows something that has previously historically been done in one way. Once the research comes in and proves that it should be done another way, it takes up to 5 years for hospitals to change their policies.
Wow.
And I'd say it's been more than that, actually.
Yes.
But yeah.
As long as that, 5 years.
Up to 5 years, yeah.
Holding the baby immediately after birth, so observing the golden hour and everything that that entails, including breastfeeding immediately and requesting breastfeeding assistance if you want it. You don't have to have it given to you.
I think that goes back to the mum's sense of trust, and it will probably have the way that she birthed and how her labor went will impact how confident she feels in those first minutes and that first hour to just hold her baby and have that skin-to-skin contact and let her baby move instinctively to the breast, because that's what you want. It's not about initiating breastfeeding and forcing that baby onto the boob. It's about being able to just like let the oxytocin and all of those beautiful hormones surge through your body, both mom and baby, and then will generally the baby will spontaneously and instinctively move towards the breast and not rushing that process. That's what the golden hour is about.
Yes.
It's not about a whole lot of things that you want to achieve. It's about settling in and allowing the hormones to guide you as to what is required and what's needed.
And then there's the whole list of postpartum preferences once you're in the maternity ward. So weighing the baby, a first bath, feeding your baby in the hospital, whether it be controlled by the nursery schedule or your baby's hunger. So then we come back to baby-friendly and mother-friendly hospitals.
Yep.
But in general, most hospitals now are baby-friendly.
I think mostly they are, and certainly they don't do the scheduled feeding anymore. And they do, majority of hospitals have a rooming in policy, which means that moms are able to feed the babies.
Yes. And then there's circumcision. But that's another topic.
Parental
all on
decision.
Its own. Parental decision. Rooming in with your baby. And other children visiting you with the baby. That's all to do with COVID restrictions
all
now.
COVID,
so
yeah.
That doesn't really feature. Postpartum medication or treatments. And your length of your hospital stay, barring complications. So coming back to it, it's all about flexibility.
And I think now we've kind of like talked a little bit about what that flexibility involves and how important the preparation is in that.
And if you have a midwife or a doula, you can always ask them to help you through the birth plan once you've written it up. I always say to my clients, write your birth plan up, make sure you do all the research, and then send it to me. And we can do some track changes. We can whittle it down to the most important and discuss the options.
What I like to do, I have the same process, and then almost interview them on their birth plan, and I ask them really difficult questions.
Yes.
About it. You know, why have you put that in? What does it mean? What would happen if this doesn't happen? How are you going to respond if this happens? And just guide them to look at different scenarios so that they see, it's not just like, okay, I've done this. It's taken us days, and they're always so excited. They finally got their answers, and then I come and just blow it all apart. But that is guiding them to be flexible and to understand the different scenarios that might occur.
And unpredictability of it all.
Absolutely. So I do think, while I'm not a huge fan of birth plans per se, I'm a huge fan of the process of creating your birth preferences and your birth wish list, because that is your preparation, and we actually have a beautiful process for that,
which
involves journaling and free writing and bringing it down and making it into really enjoyable.
And writing your birth story ahead of your birth.
Yes, write your birth story in three parts at different stages of your pregnancy. And it's a really beautiful exercise that really goes deep into your beliefs, your expectations, your cultural influences around birth, what you actually want, and also processing and validating your own knowledge about birth and encouraging you to see birth from your perspective rather than the external hospital perspective. So
thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Charlene. So I think that's a wrap for today. And we look forward to hearing your feedback and any other questions you might have around birth plans or what you would like us to discuss in future podcasts, because every week we cover topics of pregnancy, birth, motherhood. We do read your letters, and we also interview people from around the world to see what different birth practices are around the world. Share recommendations, anecdotes, funny and serious, as you've realized. And if you've enjoyed our podcast, please help us to keep on going by sharing with your friends and any other pregnant people you come across. Our comprehensive antenatal course is up for grabs on our website, so go check it out. As always, yours in pregnancy and beyond. Thanks for listening. See you next week.